All right, welcome back to Computer Science E1. My name is David Malin. This is Dan Armendariz. And what we thought we would do is begin tonight with yet one more piece of evidence that perhaps you are not among those least comfortable when it comes to computers and technology. Dan makes fun of me quite often for being about 2 years behind the times when it comes to what are called internet memes, sort of stupid internet forwards that end up in your inbox, things that people find funny and currently in vogue. Well, this is one such thing, and in fact, if you like these kinds of things, or if you have a particularly good amount of free time, we would invite you to check out a site like this, Internet Memes, which is a timeline that someone put a huge amount of time into creating back to the early 80s or 90s, whereby each of these links represents some sort of stupid or funny phenomena that has happened over time. For instance, this Icon Has Cheeseburger, this lolcat, so to speak. There's perhaps the Dancing Baby that some of you might remember from 1996. There's Stephen Colbert's at the White House dinner, which was also forwarded around. And this is a similar clip in spirit to what we saw last time. So, from YouTube.
We can handle a power saw when it comes to the power of the internet.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
Not once, but at least twice, President Bush has inexplicably added an S.
We can have filters on internets.
Leading young whippersnappers to mock him.
Everyone's on the internet.
Yes. That's our fearless leader.
Woo! And now the leader dubbed Googler in Chief by the Wall Street Journal has struck again. During a CNBC interview, the president was asked if he ever Googles.
Occasionally. And one of the things I've used on the Google is to pull up maps.
The Google? They keep ready, but the Google and techno geeks are gone. I wonder on which one of the internets he uses the Google, question one.
I mean, we could refer to it as the Google, like the Donald.
Forget the Donald.
But I'm the decider.
And when the decider says the Google, the editor who's working on a sixth edition of Bushism is the man to call. Jacob Weisberg emailed back that he was eating the lunch when we called for an interview.
It's a little bit of the way my mom talks about technology. It's so sweet, kind of endearing. She calls to tell you that she got an email.
President Bush said he uses the Google to look at satellite maps of his ranch in Crawford, Texas. Reminds me of where I want to be sometimes. But who are we to talk? I had to get my producer to help.
So we're downloading Google Earth. I'm not sure if the president did this, but then how did this? I don't know how to do this.
Next thing you know, we were zooming in on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
You practically can see him in there. He's on the internet.
Now, I'm no fan of the internet.
Comedians and internet wags have immortalized the internet.
I hear there's rumors on the internet.
As for the Google, the company says it's flattered. He can call it whatever the heck he wants to call it. Besides, he's technically correct. There is more than one internet. Internet 2 is a better, faster network used by universities and others. The president's not the only politician to get tripped up by the internet.
It's a series of tubes.
The internet is a series of tubes.
Better to have those tubes tied than the president's tongue.
And the Google.
She knows the CNN real.
Dan?
All right, and with that said, we actually want to throw you immediately into some of the fun stuff that is in this course. So if you noticed, we actually just recently put up some additional information up on the website, the most important of which is actually the first problem set. So if you go to the website, there's a link to problem sets, and you can open up the OHI problem set. It will download, and you'll notice that you have quite a bit of work to do ahead of you. So do take a look and download it. You do have, in general, for all of the problem sets in this course, 2 weeks to do them. But don't let that fool you. Do take a look at them early and get started on them early. And certainly do read through the entire thing before you do start it, just so that there are no surprises when you start to when you finish. And just to go as a quick throwback to last week, David was talking about bits and bytes and all of these things. What are bits and bytes? I know a week's a long time, but it's not that long. A bit. Let's just start with a bit. What's a bit? going to be any easier. Yes.
Either a 1 or a 0 represents 1/8 of a byte.
That's right. A bit is a 1 or a 0. And so this is how a computer communicates, either with itself or with other computers. It's how things are computed, basically. And so if a bit is a 0 or a 1, we have a byte, and that is 8 bits. So that could be, it's just a collection of 8 zeros, 8 ones, or anything in between, a combination of 8 zeros and 1s. There should be no surprises here. This is just a quick review from last week. And so what is then the representation, the numerical representation of this byte? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. Right, it's the decimal number 1, just as we have talked about. So obviously, though, everything that we do in computers isn't just in numbers. For example, a lot of the things, the characters that you see here are letters. So how does a computer represent letters? If you could only represent something with zeros or ones, how would you represent a letter in this case?
That's it.
Where it falls in the alphabet. Okay, that's very good. So you might assign a number to each letter in the alphabet. So you might say, like, capital A is the number 1, capital B is the number 2, for example. And this is exactly what happens, but unfortunately, they don't start at the letter or the number 1 for all of these. So this right here looks pretty complex, but it's just a table that's called an ASCII table. And the ASCII table just is a collection of characters that are numbered from 0 all the way to 255 and whose numerical representations match some character. So you'll see that here that there's a whole bunch of weird stuff. Decimal number 9, for example, is a horizontal tab, and we have a backspace is decimal number 8, all sorts of weird things here like data link escape, device control, but the ones that we are really interested in are the numbers, or the letters rather. You can see that it starts all the way at the top of this third column. The very top after the at sign, we see the capital letter A, which has associated with it a decimal number 65. And so all computers recognize that the decimal number 65, when used in an ASCII table, means the letter A. So this is how the capital letter A, for example, is stored in your computer. It doesn't store the letter A itself, but rather the representation of A based on this ASCII table. So remember that we don't store it even in decimal notation, but in binary. So how would a computer store the big letter A in its memory? I'll start you off with a 0. But what do we need to do in order to represent this letter A in memory? Yes.
Shove 65 on a
byte. Right, exactly. So we need to write down in a byte the number 65. Because this way the computer will be able to look up, do a reverse lookup, and say, okay, the number 65 in ASCII represents the letter A. So it would know that this representation, this binary representation of the number 65 is therefore maps to the letter A. So here's a good question. How do we convert 65 to bits or to a byte? Yes?
So 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Wait, do I have too many?
You have too many.
The last one's 2.
That's right. The last one is, that's very good. This is right. So this is 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. This is a collection of 8 bits. We have 8 zeros or 1s, and this in particular represents the number 65. So how did you get this representation in bits or byte?
Just by adding, like, fiddling with the numbers for the place settings that we talked about last time.
Okay, good. Yeah, so this is a very valid way to do it. So let's convert this back to the decimal representation of the number, so it looks more real to us. How do we do that? This is just a quick review from last week. How do we convert this byte, or this 8 bits, back to the decimal number, 65, that we are familiar with? So what is this? We'll start at this very far right. What does this 1 represent? Right, 1. So this is 2 to the 0, or 1. How about this first 0 from the right? Right, it represents 2 because it's 2 to the 1, but since it's a 0, it doesn't represent anything, so it's just a 0. So all of the rest of these, you can imagine, it goes from 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2, and the reason that I'm doing it this way is because 2 to the 0 is 1. So this is the 1's place. 2 to the 1 is 2. So this second one is the 2's place. And the 4's place, the 8's place, 16, 32. And then this last one is 64. So 2 to the 6th is 64. So 1 times 2 to the 6th is 64. So 64 plus 1 is 65. So that is how we are able to know that in this ASCII table, this binary representation, 01000001, represents the number 65 and therefore maps to the big capital letter A. So then what is the binary representation of the big capital letter B? This should be easy now that we know what A is. Right. Just move the 1 over. So if I erase all of this stuff, we have 01000010. That's right. So all you're doing is essentially counting up from this representation or this byte right here. So you'll notice one additional thing is that there is a separation. There is a difference between the uppercase letters and the lowercase letters. Specifically, uppercase letters start at the number 65, and lowercase letters start at the number 97. So this is how a computer is able to tell the difference between uppercase and lowercase letters. It just has a different numerical representation within the ASCII table.
How does it know you're representing a letter rather than a number?
So how does it know that you are representing a letter rather than a number? So every byte has associated with it some type, like the computer knows what type of data that is. And so in almost every case, when you are talking about characters, whenever some byte in memory is called a character, then it knows to use this ASCII table. So it knows that the byte that is in memory for a character type, it knows that it has to look up this number in the ASCII table to display that character on the screen or to manipulate it somehow. Any other questions? Yes.
Did you answer how to convert that to decimal?
How to convert this to decimal? Yes, I did. So the way that we converted this to decimal was just to consider what every place means in this byte. Yep. So the very first place means one, the second place is two, and then since you progressively times 2 times all of these, the previous place, it's 1, 2, 4, so I'll write this down, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, right? So what you do from here is you multiply the 0 or the 1 times what that place should be. So 0 times 1, for example, is equal to 0. 1 times 2 is equal to 2. 0 times 4 is equal to 0. 0 times 8 is equal to 0. 0 times 16, 0. So on and so forth until we get to 64 times 1, which is 64 right here. Then you add up all of the values down here. So we have 0 plus 64 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 2 plus 0 is what? 66. That's right. So this representation 01000010 is the number, the decimal number 66. Yes.
The ampersand and the number sign.
Yes.
Presumably those are
Right. So, well, that ampersand.
You need to know, like, the binary to get the symbols that come before the number that we're turning into the binary to get the character.
Wait, that makes sense? I'm not sure I understand your question.
If everything has to be in binary, mm-hmm. and that's the ASCII table, so everything yes. has to be in binary for that too, those symbols that come before the numbers, like we just did A, so 65. Mm-hmm.
Oh, the number sign and the ampersand, that's for something different. That's for the representation. That's for representing this character in HTML, for example, which we haven't really talked about. So you can completely ignore this column.
Okay.
The one that we are worried about right now is this decimal column, this far left and the far right within the row. Because this is the decimal number that I'm talking about in this far left of the column, and this is the character that refers or that comes about from that decimal number in this column. So there are additional ones like hexadecimal that's just another numbering scheme, and there's also octal, but those numbers we don't really care about right now. It's just the decimal version and its binary representation. So you certainly don't have to memorize this entire ASCII table because it's a lot, but there are some important ones to remember, specifically capital letter A, because then you could derive all of the other capital letters from it, and lowercase a, so 65 and 97 respectively. From there, you can figure out all of the other uppercase and lowercase letters. And really from there, you just have to Google around, use the Google for search for an ASCII table, and you'd be able to find something exactly like this. And certainly if you don't know the rest, that's really all you would have to do. Okay, are there any questions on converting to decimal, what the ASCII table is, et cetera? Okay, so now, how many of you have ever wanted to, or how many of you have ever gone to a web page or a website to buy a computer and just been befuddled by all of the options that are available to you? Well, good, we are here to help make that a little bit more simple. David.
Dump that on me.
Yeah, the
whole so, thing. Going to need a screen here, and what you're about to see on the screen is just Dell.com. So one of the most popular places to turn to for PCs these days is Dell, because they do tend to have very good prices and pretty much commodity hardware. Another, perhaps sexier alternative, of course, is, when I alt-tab, what are you about to see? So who could not love this kind of hardware as well? You'll find that Dan and I, at least, are fairly agnostic when it comes to this, since both of us use Macs and PCs. And so we're certainly not here to preach either one or the other. But it turns out there's striking similarities between both Macs and PCs these days. Not only do they have the same basic functionality for the most part, they also have a lot of the same hardware these days. Apple, as you might have read a couple years ago now, switched from PowerPC processors, if you remember the nomenclature, to Intel processors, Intel x86 processors, which makes them even more like PCs, and it also helped with the price points as well. So what we thought we'd do today is try to frame much of our discussion of computer hardware through the sort of lens that is consumerism, because when you go to a store, or you go to one of these websites and look at what hardware is available to you, there's certainly a lot of numbers, and there's a lot of acronyms, and there's a lot of jargon that actually lends itself to some interesting discussions of trade-offs, of features and such, but it's also sort of interesting sort of computer science-like stuff underneath as well. What you'll find in forthcoming problem set, not this first one, but a future one, is that one of your homework assignments will be to, as Dan said last week, go shopping with a few, couple thousand virtual dollars of the courses. We seem to get away with giving out fewer and fewer virtual dollars each year, but this will be an experience that by that point in the course, about a month or so in, hopefully you will find that in asking questions of the salesman, pretending that you actually have real dollars that you're inclined to spend, you might very well find that you do in fact finally know a bit more than them about this topic or that. And it's going to be an exercise in shopping for a computer without actually completing the transaction at the very end, unless you're so inclined. That's where we will bail out ourselves. So just a show of hands, perhaps, even though we can probably guess based on societal statistics, which of you here use a Mac as your primary computer? Okay, and You, of course, yes. Right there. Okay, so it's like a quarter or a third of you in PCs. I'm guessing the rest of the hands will go up. Okay, so just to play favorites here, let's go ahead and start with Dell.com. And the takeaways here aren't so much what Dell is offering per se, but to think of it as fairly representative of other popular manufacturers out there. And one of the takeaways we hope you'll get from this course is that really, you should feel, one, comfortable shopping online these days. E-commerce and inputting your credit card number online, even if you don't do this that often, really isn't or shouldn't be such a scary thing these days. And two, you frankly tend to get much better pricing online than you would going into a Staples or even a Best Buy or similar stores. Now, it might be a lot easier to sort of shop because you like to see what you're getting. You can see demonstrations and such. But if price is your greater concern, certainly turning online is very viable option. I would say, at the risk of generalizing, sort of real computer people tend not to go to sort of these kinds of stores and storefronts because you tend to pay a premium because they can sort of lure people in and then you pay for that convenience, for that perhaps lack of familiarity with alternatives. So here's Dell's site. I am going to go to For Home just because we'll do maybe use the Mac for laptops and the PCs for desktops. Let's go to Dell here. And Dell's website has the upside of being very flexible, giving you lots of options, and it has the downside of being very overwhelming with too many options and with failure to elaborate on some of their details. But such is the place that many people shop. What's remarkable about Dell in particular and other hardware manufacturers like them is just the ridiculous amount of features you get for the prices these days. So case in point, let me go ahead and, overwhelmed as I already am, I'm going to zoom in on Inspiron desktops, which is sort of their cheapest end desktop models. Plenty good for surfing the web, writing essays and whatnot. It's kind of hard to beat a starting price of $279, down from, you know, 10 times that just a few years ago for similar base configurations. So let's see what we'll get. And then we'll use this as a point of departure for talking about some of the features, some of the hardware, and some of the technology underlying these things. So here's a few different models. Looks like they're all called Inspirons. We got the 530S, whatever that is, 530, 630, M1730. But let's scroll down a bit further. Let's assume that money is kind of an object. So we'll stray from these higher end models, maybe focus more on the left, and let's see what's inside these things. So inside of these computers is this thing at top, and it's a little small, but that first row right below the name of the model is what type, what piece of hardware? Yeah, so that's the processor, the CPU, or central processing unit, the brains of the computer. For now, faster is probably better, though within reason, because you, the human, are probably the limiting factor in most of the things your computer does. You can only type instant messages or email so fast. Your computer probably doesn't need to do 2 billion things at once, 2 gigahertz at once, in order to get that email on its way. So we'll see, too, that you can certainly overpay sometimes. Next is operating system, which for the most part is going to be Windows if you're shopping in a PC world, although alternatives that maybe techier people tend to use these days? Yeah, so Linux of some sort, many different versions and flavors, but it certainly hasn't made the inroads that some folks might like in the consumer world. Monitor, no monitor, optical drive. So, and first we'll do a cursory explanation of some of these, then dive in deeper. Why? What is an optical drive, or an example thereof? Yeah, so DVD, CD drive, why are they called optical drives, though? Yeah, so they use lasers, right? Even if you're not so familiar with your computer, you probably know that like your stereo system that uses CDs is read by some kind of laser light. And we'll actually look inside one such thing by way of a video in a bit. Next thing on the list is memory. So there's a bunch of different types of memories, as Dan was saying last week. You've got RAM, you've got, what else? Hard disk space, you've got things called cache, as Dan mentioned toward the end of last week. So different types of memory, but for the most part, when someone says, how much memory does your computer have, they're talking about RAM. And it's sort of the mark of a person who knows what they're talking about if they answer that question in terms of RAM and not say hard disk space. So just in terms of bringing oneself up to speed. Next, though, comes hard drives, which, yes, are a form of RAM, right? Which, yes, are a type of memory, but distinct from RAM in what huge way? What was one of the most important differences, Dan said last week, between RAM and hard disks?
RAM is temporary. Hard drives store
Yeah, so RAM is temporary and hard drives store data permanently. So this is to say when you boot up your computer and you double click on, say, Microsoft Word on your desktop or some similar program, well, that program is a whole bunch of zeros and ones that Microsoft created and sort of laid out in on disk for you in certain patterns that your CPU understands. When you double click them, those bits that are currently on which form of memory? The hard disk, assuming you've installed this before or it came installed on your computer, well, those bits or many of them are loaded into RAM. And while you're using that program, say Microsoft Word, those bits live in RAM for the most part. And they get fed, maybe one after the other or a whole bunch at a time, into the CPU so that the CPU can sort of read them, do its thing, and make Word behave in the manner you would expect. But then they stay in RAM for the most part. Now, why this duality? If you've already got some type of memory, hard disks, which have the upside of persisting even when the power is off, what was the reason for even having this second type of memory called RAM? Yeah, exactly. So to spin it around, RAM is much faster than a hard disk. Or conversely, a hard disk is relatively slow. Intuitively, this is the case because a hard disk is a mechanical device. And it's probably reasonable to, it's probably not hard to convince you that something that has to physically spin is going to tend to be slower than something that's purely electronic and only relies on the flow of electricity. Because if we really want to go to an extreme, electricity, Well, let's not go to that extreme just yet. It's faster if it's purely electric or electronic as opposed to something physical. And in fact, just to make this a bit more real, Dan, do we have the hard drive floating around already?
Oh, no, I haven't taken it apart yet, but...
So in just a few moments' time, Dan will have taken apart that hard drive since we found the right screwdriver. Found the right screwdriver this week to actually show you what's inside of that, and what you'll get a sense of is exactly what it is that's moving inside that hard disk, but we'll see it with an actual example thereof. Okay, so we have these two types of memory, RAM and hard disks. Hard disks are slower, but they have the upside of storing your data long term. RAM is faster. The problem is, though, if you have some document stored in RAM, like you're writing an essay or you're writing a letter, and just like Microsoft Word, that letter or essay is similarly going to live in RAM while you're typing it because it's faster, what's the implication then of, say, a lightning bolt or, say, the power going out if what you're doing is living in RAM? Right, you kind of lose it. Right, so if you've ever lost data because of some power failure or doing something stupid like kicking the cord out of the machine or whatnot, that's because your work was probably stored in RAM. But the act of going to the file menu and going to save, well, what does that do? Well, it says take what's in RAM and dump it onto the hard disk and then keep it in RAM so that I can continue working on it for the most part. And only once you go to file quit or exit does the RAM get flushed of those bits and then what's on the hard drive stays, in fact, on the hard drive. So there's an interesting point, though, to make here already. So notice these two rows, RAM, aka memory, and hard disks. What's sort of striking about the two in terms of the difference between them? What's that? The size, right? This is an order of magnitude bigger. It looks like this computer on the left is going to come with 2 gigabytes of RAM. And that, you know, RAM-wise sounds pretty big, but hard disk-wise, it's going to come with 320 gigabytes of RAM. So we seem to have this interesting relationship whereby you have more of the slower stuff and less of the faster stuff, which seems completely counterintuitive, because wouldn't you think it'd be better to have more of the faster stuff and less of the slower stuff? So why might this be the reality? So which is where you're going to store? Okay, so indeed, that's where you're going to store all your data and your programs. So you do want a lot of space to persist long term. But let me push back and say, all right, fine. Well, give me at least as much RAM, if not more, because it's so much faster. I would think that that would then allow me to do even more on my computer at once, if not faster. What might explain this disparity in sizes? So there is indeed a technical explanation here, which is that given the way humans have designed computers to operate, like Dan was describing last week, whereby you have the hard drive, then you have RAM, then you have the CPU, sort of in increasing order of speed, well, things kind of work nicely this way, and you don't need it so much. But there's an even bigger kicker here, sort of a simpler explanation. Oh, good question. Will more RAM slow down the information? I would answer in general, no. So that would not, in fact, be a concern. Yeah?
Is the information stored on RAM compressed?
Interesting conjecture. Is the information stored on RAM compressed? Generally not. Certainly not by default. And your hint is in my right hand. Yeah. Yes, it's more expensive. So the technology used to implement RAM at present is simply more expensive, an order of magnitude more expensive than hard disk space. And so you simply have less of it, or perhaps man has sort of designed computers in such a way at present so that you need less of it because it is relatively more expensive. Now, fortunately, all of these prices are coming down over time, right? The reason that even your iPods have more and more storage space isn't so much that Apple's getting more and more generous, but rather the stuff is getting cheaper and cheaper, whether it's flash-based memory in some of the iPods or even small hard disks in others of them. Well, what else? It looks like we have some discretion perhaps over video cards, over sound cards, both of which sort of do the obvious, but there's subtleties there as well. And then you have these limited warranties and such. So let me, before I turn things over to Dan to dive a bit deeper into at least one of these topics, let's take a look at what constitutes Dell's custom configuration. And it's here where I would say a lot of typical, normal people sort of get tripped up, either because they're just not familiar with the various trade-offs and the various options and technologies, or frankly, it's not presented in a terribly clear way. One of the most brilliant things Apple has done in marketing a lot of its machines is they pretty much have taken the approach of good, better, best. And even if you don't quite understand all of the subtleties among the different models, you at least have a general sense and a general price point in your mind, presumably, whereby you can choose, do I need top of the end or sort of middle of the road or maybe the low end? Probably motivated mostly by price. But even then, as we'll see, if you dive in deeper into any of those models of Apple's generally, you then too get the ability to tweak this and that and bump this up and bump this down. And it's at that point you probably head into the Apple store or pick up the phone or just frankly give it a go on your own. So let's just get a sense of what the trade-offs here are and then dive in to at least how some of these things work. So it looks like for the processor option, Dell sort of lays things out from left to right. It looks like, my God, we have four different processor options. Can you get a sense of what the trade-offs seem to be here? I mean, what are you getting by paying $20 more or $80 more or $130 more? What's changing? Sorry? Yeah, so the gigahertz, the speed of these things. So there's this interesting topic of how these things are rated in terms of speed. There's other numbers there still. Let's skip ahead to say memory and hard disk. So memory, this one's a little more obvious. So more is probably better. But I say probably because if you're not going to actually use that much memory, well, perhaps you don't actually need it. In fact, certain operating systems, like the original version of Windows XP, can't handle more than, say, 3 gigabytes of RAM. So you can buy as much as you want, put it in your computer. It's not going to see it, quite literally. Well, what about this last link for hard drives? Well, under hard drives, here too, we have some interesting options. We've got a 320 gigabytes, 500, 700, 640. Now, you can probably walk away from that thinking, all right, so more is probably better, albeit at some cost. But parenthetically, at least in this case, it looks like there's this other metric. So not only are hard drives apparently rated in terms of size, what's the parenthetical remark referring to, if you know? Sorry? So RPMs is rotations per minute. So a typical hard drive actually does spin at 7,200 rotations per minute or revolutions per minute. So it's pretty darn fast. In 60 seconds, it literally spins 360 degrees 7,200 times. But not in this case, but in general, there are hard drives that spin at 5,400 RPM, 4,500 RPM, even 10,000 RPM. And what do you think you're gaining by going with, say, a faster hard drive, like 7,200 versus 5,400? faster memory recall. So things load off the hard drive faster, and that sort of seems pretty intuitive. What are you losing by going with a faster hard drive, perhaps? That is, what if you buy a 7200 RPM drive versus the 5400 drive, what's the downside, perhaps? What's that? Good. So one that most people might not think of, noise. If you have a computer in your bedroom or in a room where you probably don't want to hear the computer's presence, the faster something's spinning, odds are the louder it's going to be, the more decibels or fractions thereof that it's going to give off. What else is a downside? Heat is another one. Maybe not such a big deal for most places, but even these days, I have this ridiculously large LCD monitor, 30-inch monitor, which itself actually gives off a decent amount of heat. So generally speaking, bigger or faster translates into more heat, which also has the downside of your electric bill, perhaps, too. So that as well, if not the cost thereof.
This brings up an interesting point. If we can go back to processor, please, David. So now I just want to go into a little bit more information about some of these individual components. And specifically, what I want to talk about is the processor, or the CPU. And so we have here various options, but what I have in my hand is an old Pentium 2 processor. Do any of you remember the commercials from way back then? I mean, this is an aging old processor, and most of you, well, I would hope that many of you have moved on from such a processor to a more modern one. But this just shows you that, I mean, they have a fancy little hologram. This isn't actually the chip. Everyone thinks it's the chip, but it isn't. But you can see that they have on the underside here what I was referring to last week, the heat sink. This is the big metallic object that dissipates the heat. And really, the chip inside of this is quite a bit smaller, and the purpose of this size really is just to make it easier to dissipate a lot of this heat. And David was talking about how things in general that are faster usually give off more heat, and how do we measure the speed in these processors? Yeah, and hertz. What is, we talk about megahertz and gigahertz, but what is a hertz? What are we referring to when we say hertz? Something, this is 1 gigahertz or 1 megahertz or 1,000 megahertz, for example. Yes. Right, so it's the speed, and it's a little bit oversimplified to call it the speed, but it certainly is, it's the clock speed. It's what a hertz is that it's doing something in 1 second. So let's see if I can, oops. So if I can, I'll go ahead and pass around this Pentium 2 processor just so that everybody can take a look at it. But in direct competition to Intel's Pentium 2 processor at the time was Apple, of course. And they actually had an interesting commercial from way back in the day referencing the speed of the Pentium 2 processor. Yes?
Sorry, just a question. What does a processor size look like now?
What does a processor size look like now? Well, they usually are square. And probably no more than 2 inches by 2 inches size. David is showing us right now on the logic board, or on this motherboard, there's a little square right here that shows the size of a modern processor. And usually it's so big not because the chip has to be large, but just because there's so many pins, so many connections that have to be made between the CPU or the processor itself and the rest of the logic board. They can't make all of the pins that make the connections so small because they'll break. So they do have to be some reasonable size. So that's why these processors are as large as they are. But we'll get to size in just a little bit. What I did want to show was this commercial from Apple way back when referencing the Pentium 2. So I don't know if you could see, but in the small text at the bottom, it said just how quick it was, and it said 266 megahertz. And now by modern equivalents, both of these computers are snails, and they do actually operate quite slowly compared to modern machines. But why is it that why is it that we say that something that is, let's say, 4 gigahertz is faster than something else that is 3 gigahertz? So we said 1 hertz is basically a unit of measure that just says that the processor is doing something in a unit of time. So if we're doing 4 billion somethings versus 3 billion somethings, you would say, you know, per second, then you would say that, well, this is a faster processor, right? So that's the reasoning really behind a lot of these CPUs. And what companies did, like Intel and even Apple did for a long time, was talk about how, you know, they would just plaster on the megahertz onto their CPUs and say, okay, well, mine is, you know, 4 gigahertz, and oh, mine is 4.1 gigahertz, and mine is 4.123 gigahertz. And so what they would infer, or what people would guess from this, is that, well, these processors that have a higher gigahertz rating must be faster. However, from what I am getting at, you can probably infer that this isn't necessarily, or it isn't always the case. And the reason that this came up initially was that a processor doesn't actually do one computation in that 1 hertz. So when we say 4 billion hertz or 4 gigahertz, it's not actually doing 4 billion computations in a second. It's actually a lot more complex than that. We were talking about how in order for a CPU to do something to some data, what has to happen? What has to happen for a CPU to do something? Right, so so let's go even more basic. It has to have data to do something with. So this means that the CPU has to obtain its data from somewhere. So maybe from the cache, maybe from the RAM. But the point is that the CPU takes one of these cycles, one of these gigahertz cycles, to, let's say, fetch memory from the cache. So now it has one number. Now it has to fetch another one from the cache. So now we've already done, in two of these cycles, two of these 4 gigahertz cycles, just obtaining data to do something with it. Now we don't yet know what we have to do with this data. So in yet another cycle, the CPU says, okay, what am I supposed to do? And now it's given an instruction, such as an addition, a subtraction, a multiplication. And it's that instruction that it then performs on those two numbers that it had loaded from memory. So already you can see that what is happening is that in one cycle, in 4 gigahertz, it's not actually doing 4 billion computations per second. It has to do a number of other things as well.
So it's not using a hertz to do those things?
Right. Well, 1 hertz really is... It's so that the CPU itself does actually operate in the 4 gigahertz or higher range, or 3 gigahertz or 2 gigahertz, depending on the processor. But what's happening is that remember that 1 hertz just means that it's one cycle, you know, it's performing one thing, or rather, when we say, let's say, it's doing, if it has 2 hertz, for example, it's doing 2 cycles per second, 3 hertz, 3 cycles per second. But in each of these cycles, it's not doing one computation, like many of these companies would have you believe. What's actually happening is that it has to do some things before it can actually perform the computation. So it might use one of these cycles to obtain memory or to obtain some data from memory, and then another cycle to obtain the other bit of memory. And then finally, it will be able to do something to those. So it's not just doing in one of these cycles, you know, one computation. And so this is, I mean, it's a little bit more complex than this, but it is, yes?
So if I could simplify, are you saying that it could be doing 1, 2, 3, and then the computation, and then a series of hertz?
Yes, it is doing a number of steps before the computation in each of these cycles. So...
But the computation is going to, if I'm understanding this correctly, the computation won't come until...
Right, so so remember that when we're talking about hertz, all that is measuring is just, it's just performing something, some cycle, we can say, every second. So when we say, if we say 1 hertz, then it's performing one thing every second. If it's 2 hertz, it's 2 things every second. If it's 4 billion hertz, then it's 4 billion of something every second. But just assuming that these processors do a computation 4 billion times every second is incorrect, and it's a bit of an oversimplification. What actually happens is that in each of these, so one of the 4 billion things in that second will have to be obtaining something from memory. So you can imagine that the first thing it has to do is obtain something and load it into memory. Then the second thing it has to do is load something else into memory. So one every four billionth of a second it loads the first thing, the next 4 billionth it loads the second thing, then it can perform the computation on that.
So it can't do two things in one cycle.
Right, it cannot do two things in one cycle.
Oh, okay.
So then it performs the computation on that, and then it can say write it to memory, for example. So you notice that there's a number of steps that are involved in this. And this is actually called, it's a bit more complex, but this is actually called the CPU's pipeline, because it has to perform a number of things before it can actually do some computation.
And is that also a series of cycles as well as a series of hertz?
Series of cycles. So this is just one cycle. So when we say 4 billion hertz, for example, what we're saying is that the CPU can perform one of these steps in 1/4 billionth of a second. So the faster your CPU, the less time it takes you to perform these steps. However, CPUs have different length pipelines. So some CPUs can do it in 4 steps. Some require, let's say, 10 steps, for example. So in these CPUs, even though you have faster hertz or more hertz per second, it may have more steps to do in order to do a particular computation. Well, a longer pipeline would have more steps here. So if we have obviously a shorter pipeline is better because then, well, just in this case, because then we could do in the same amount of time more things because it has less steps to do in order to perform one computation.
So if there's a particular takeaway here, frankly, it's just the complexity of what goes on, say, in one sort of click of the clock. A tick of the clock, and it wasn't really quite fair of Apple, for instance, to compare their CPUs against Intel's. Back in the day, PowerPC processors were known as RISC processors, reduced instruction set computers, and what this meant was that what they do is much simpler than what a typical Intel CPU did per unit of time. So Intel CPUs were and are CISC computers, complex instruction set computers, which means for every toll of the clock, Intel CPU tends to do more in that tick of time than did an Apple one. So really what Apple was doing was somewhat unfair in comparing apples and oranges. And this sort of takeaway is still true today, whereby if you're considering, say, some Mac and some PC, don't simply conclude that, well, this 2.2 gigahertz PC is clearly faster than this 1.8 gigahertz Mac, because there's so many differences beyond the actual clock speed of these CPUs. One, the operating systems are completely different. The programs you are going to be running are completely different. And up until recently, so were the CPUs themselves different. So really, when you're comparing for consumer purposes, you really want to sort of compare apples to apples within the same domain. This PC CPU versus this one. And sort of not try to cross-compare or make claims as to one computer being faster than the other. And even these days, if you read magazines about which computer is fastest, sort of in the consumer report style, there's no sort of one metric that you can use and say, this computer is faster, and therefore you should buy this one, because it completely depends on the application that you care about, on the types of usage that you care about. And so all you can really get from reading like PC World and PC PC Magazine, when you're reading reviews like this, is sort of get a general sense of what a computer performs well at. But frankly, that's typically only of interest to very specialized sort of folks who care really about using Photoshop or who really care about multimedia development. For typical usage, it doesn't really matter as much. And in fact, do you mind if I point one thing out on Dell's site? So one of the interesting things to note in terms of these trade-offs, especially as they relate to sort of normal users who really just want to come home and check their mail and maybe write up a document, maybe manage some files and finances, relatively computationally unintensive applications, notice how these prices actually go up. So the top CPU there selected by default that's included in our price is 2 gigahertz. So that's what we're going to get by default. Notice we can pay $20 more for the next button and get how fast of a CPU? So at 2.2 gigahertz, so 200 megahertz more for just $20. So there's sort of, we're getting a 0.1 gigahertz increase for every $10 we spend. But now keep that sort of ratio in mind. What happens when you go one step further down the list? You're paying $80 more, but you're not getting 0.8 gigahertz more, aka 800 megahertz more. You're only getting 0.53. or 530 megahertz more. Go one step further, you pay $130, you're only getting 830 megahertz more. So sort of the price doesn't, the performance doesn't necessarily follow the price as you go up and up and up. And so the takeaway that most people get from this, or the rule of thumb that many people live by, is that you really shouldn't pay for the bleeding edge, because you're going to overpay for it in terms of dollars per CPU cycles. And again, that's a rule of thumb. It's not to say that that computer is not, say, $130 better, so to speak, than the cheaper one. But this is probably to say that, frankly, even if you click that bottommost box and say, you know what, I really want the fastest computer on the market today, odds are by the time it ships, there's going to be a fifth option that Dell is now marketing. So you're never going to stay ahead of the curve in this world.
Right. And like David said, the takeaway really is that it is really complex. And this pipeline is, what I was trying to do is show that you really cannot compare two different processors against each other, because you really only can compare two of the same types in terms of gigahertz between one and the other. So just a few years ago, Intel was coming out with these Pentium 4 processors, and they went all the way up to, the high 3 gigahertz, and I think low 4 gigahertz. But those were incredibly inefficient. They had really, really long pipelines, so they were generating lots of heat, and they sounded like they were doing things much very quickly, but they just really weren't. They were very inefficient. They were very cumbersome. And eventually what they did was switch to these new models, these dual-core processors and all these other monikers that they have that are much more efficient. So even though these are now 2 gigahertz, for example, their pipelines may be a lot shorter, so therefore they can do more with this, you know, decrease in speed, if that makes sense. So it's really difficult to compare the two different processors against each other. Yes? Oh, yeah, we're going to talk about that in just one second. I think I saw a question here.
What is FSB?
FSB means front side bus, and that is usually measured in megahertz or gigahertz. We can tell from this that it's probably measured in megahertz here, just because it, having 1,333 gigahertz front side bus sounds completely unreasonable. It's usually, that's about right for this processor, but remember that the front side bus is the bus, or it's that item on the motherboard that basically shuffles data between the processor and the RAM, for example. So that tells you how quickly data can move between the RAM, for example, and the processor, though that, of course, is an oversimplification. So if we were to go to cores, so one of the things that Intel did and other companies have done, rather than simply increasing the gigahertz or the megahertz in their processors, is they've added additional cores to these processors. And what it really is are very basically, you can think of it as being two processors on one single CPU. So in this Pentium 2 that I've been passing around, for example, what they have done is, rather than it being one core, like this one block of CPU that's on here, they now will have two right next to each other. So your computer, for example, will think of it as being two separate processors in your computer. And so if you have more than two, you could have, they now have 4-core and 8-core machines and all these things. What it actually does is it doesn't actually make the computation of one thing faster. So for example, it's not going to make it faster to add two numbers together, but it will make it faster to do multiple things at once. Just because each of these individual cores may still be measured in gigahertz or megahertz, they won't necessarily, you can't necessarily multiply it. So we can't say, for example, that if we were to move from this dual core processor at 2 gigahertz to a quad core processor at 2 gigahertz, it's not going to be twice as fast necessarily. Just because that one computation, that one addition that you're doing, for example, will still happen in that 2 gigahertz speed. Where it really improves is when you're doing multiple things at once. And if your operating system is smart enough to, you know, sort of balance that load, let's say you are playing a game and listening to music or something like that, what this, the operating system might do is devote one CPU or one of the cores to listening to the music, for example, and the other one to the processing of the game. Again, that's an over, it's a little bit of an oversimplification, but it's a mistake to say that the more cores you have, or to compare, let's say, a four-core machine that has the same gigahertz as a two-core machine, it's a mistake to call it twice as fast as that two-core machine. But really, you can think of it essentially as just being two CPUs in one, or four CPUs in one.
So let's summarize some of these numbers, since we've been jumping around and looking at various options, but so that you get a sense of the orders of magnitude to expect, it looks like, and I'll just make a little cheat sheet here, that CPUs these days seem to come in what unit is their speed measured? Just to recap. So gigahertz, so some number of billions things per second. So what are reasonable values based on what we've seen from Dell's side at least? Yeah, so like 2.0 gigahertz, maybe 2.4 gigahertz. So let's say maybe I'd say reasonable these days might be something in the like 1.2 to 3.0 range. But again, that's sort of a moving target. But it gives you a sense of at least of what's out there. What else though was attached to this computer that we've discussed? Well, we talked about RAM. So what was sort of a ballpark figure for RAM when we first pulled up Dell's site? What's that? 1 and 2 gigabytes, yeah, and I'll even go a little lower, even though this is really kind of pushing it now. 512 megabytes is, you're kind of eking by, but, you know, your geekier friends might start to tease you. And then we're going up to 1 gigabyte, 2 gigabytes. I think my most recent machine, well, this is an exercise in excessiveness, 10 gigabytes, but it's cheap. Like, it's really cheap these days, certainly relatively speaking. I remember, and not to pine for yesteryear too much, when I was in college and had a Mac PowerBook 540C, kind of, you look at it now and it's like, it really belongs and sort of behind glass in the Science Center. But I think we spent like $250 to upgrade my RAM from the 4 megabytes that came with it to guess how many megabytes. I think that was almost as bad. 32. So to buy 32 megabytes of RAM, it was like $250. Now, what was the starting price for this computer when we a moment ago? You know, $269 for the whole darn computer. Now, granted, you can come up with an infinite number of such examples, but it's also kind of exciting, too, because these things are only going to get better, and you're only going to have more and more power underneath the hood of your computer. But the more interesting question, perhaps, is, you know, who cares? What can you actually do with it? So that's the kind of range maybe these days for RAM, but there's another value. In fact, if we look at Dell's website here, there's yet another value besides front-side bus, because front-side bus tends to be a function of the motherboard that's coming in the computer, in part, or of the CPU. You know, more is probably better, just intuitively. It can move bits across the motherboard faster. But again, who cares, maybe, unless you have specialized purposes. But there's another number in parentheses here, which is what? Yeah, this thing called L2 cache, which Dan talked about toward the end of last Monday. So we seem to have something called L2 cache, which appears to come in units like 1 megabyte, it seems, 3 megabytes, 6 megabytes. And so there, too, more is probably better. It's clearly present in smaller quantities than RAM, because what's the relationship here? Well, just to recap some of the ideas from tonight and last week, if you have if you have your hard disk here, HDD, that's generally pretty big, so hundreds of gigabytes these days. That sort of leads you down the road to RAM. Right, so your bits are stored permanently on your hard disk. Double click some icon, they're loaded from hard disk into RAM. The RAM then feeds these bits into, take a guess, so L2 cache. From there, they actually go into, well, if there's L2 cache, there maybe is L1 cache, which is true, and it's actually a type of memory that's generally burned into the CPU itself. It's not external. It's actually in the essence of the CPU. And then finally does this pathway, so to speak, ultimately dead end in the CPU. But there are, of course, arrows in the other direction as well. And so what you have, to be clear, is a whole lot of storage space that's kind of slow but really cheap, leading to something that's a little smaller but faster, but a little pricier, to faster still, so that what this means is that you're kind of always have this, not to conflate terms, but this pipeline of information that's really always full at the fastest point because you are dumping more and more bits into it. And what this tends to do is optimize the performance of your computer because the CPU always has something ready and waiting for it because of this increasing speed the closer you get to it.
Okay, so that sounds good. Let's just take a quick 5-minute break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about CPUs. Okay, hi everyone, welcome back. So one of the things that we want to do this semester is actually just talk about tech news, sort of current events sort of thing, just to bring you up to speed and make you more familiar with some of the happenings around the interwebs, the intertubes, and just to make you more familiar with tech news in general. And this is something posted by Engadget. Remember that last week we mentioned Engadget as being this popular tech blog. And this headline reads, IBM shoots for 22 nanometer processor, bragging rights. So what's important here is not the bragging rights necessarily, but that they are making a processor that is 22 nanometers. What does this mean, this 22 nanometers? Sorry? The size of what? So not exactly the size of the processor, but it is the size of the little tiny wires that exist in the processor, because 22 nanometers is very, very small. The guy would not be able to hold it between his fingers. For comparison, the typical width of a human hair is 100 microns, which is 100,000 nanometers. So we're talking very, very, very small little pieces of silicon that are here that exist inside of this chip. And so all this means is that in order for us to be able to process things more quickly or increase the gigahertz or to be able to just perform computations more quickly, we have to shrink the size of these processors so that all of the transistors are the things that actually do the computation, so that they're closer together and that all of these things that happen inside of the processor just happen much more quickly. And so currently we're at about, 45 nanometers, and many of you probably have computers that are at 90 nanometers or 130 nanometers in size, or the processor specifically. But all this really is saying is that we are now reaching even smaller stages. So now CPUs can continue to become faster and smaller and dissipate less heat. And so there is actually a physical limit. As you can imagine, we can't keep making things much smaller in size, but hopefully for the time being, we can continue to shrink and just make things quicker and faster. But there is one more thing that I wanted to talk about briefly with CPUs before we move on, and that is this relatively new notion of 32-bit versus 64-bit CPUs. It's always a marketing thing to be able to market these CPUs as having higher bits or whatever, but what exactly does this mean? Well, there are a number of things that it actually means. There's a number of differences inside of the CPU that account for the difference between a 32-bit CPU and a 64-bit CPU. But one of the most important things is how many bits or how many bytes of information that CPU can reference from RAM. So if we have a 32-bit CPU, we can only obtain 2 to the 32nd bytes from RAM. And how many is that? So we can only have this many bytes of RAM. How many is this? 2 to the 32. This is sort of an important number. You don't have to know exactly how much, but it's sort of important to know that this means approximately 4 billion. So what this is saying is that a 32-bit CPU can only address 4 billion bytes of RAM, which is about 4 gigabytes of RAM. That was a hard limit for a long time. So not only, like David said, did Windows XP give you this sort of soft limit where it could only access 3 gigabytes of RAM, there's also a hard limit in many of these computers where you just shouldn't put more than 4 gigabytes of RAM inside of your computer, because nothing that you are going to be able to do is going to make that extra RAM accessible. So what this means is that only the first 4 gigabytes will be able to store data in it, to store your applications, to store your documents that you're working on, and the rest will be just ignored, just because the processor doesn't know how to access it, doesn't know what what it means to have more than 4 gigabytes. And so what a 64-bit processor will allow us to do eventually is to increase this by some dramatic amount, some number in the trillions, where no longer do we have this hard set limit of 4 gigabytes of RAM, but we can have more RAM inside of a computer. So like David was saying, his computer has about 10 gigabytes. I have 6 gigabytes of RAM in my computer. This wouldn't be possible if our processors were 32-bit. We have to have these 64-bit processors inside. And so it's not that these 64-bit processors necessarily are faster or are much better than their 32-bit companions. It's just that, among other things, they can access a lot more RAM, which is very useful considering how bloated a lot of these applications are getting. Windows Vista needs like 3 gigabytes of RAM just to run, but that's my quick jab for the day. But speaking of space that's needed, one of the things, like we've been talking about, that you need is a large hard drive to store all of this. But how does a hard drive work?
That's quite the setup. Well, let's turn our attention to figuratively and then literally what's inside of a hard drive. So we know from last week the data all boils down to zeros and ones. And I think we said briefly, if nothing else, that we can represent these zeros and ones in a bunch of different ways, by storing an electrical charge or not, turning a light bulb on or off. We can also do it magnetically. We can take a magnetic particle and say, you know what, if it's positioned north-south, as you may recall, magnetic particles often are, let's call that a one. But if it's south-north, well, let's call it a zero, so long as we're consistent and come up with a scheme like that. Well, that's pretty much what's going on inside of, say, floppy disks from yesteryear, and also hard drives these days, because inside of a hard drive, which looks like this object that we will be, that is currently being passed around, or is over in your hands?
What? The which?
The hard drive? Hard drive.
No, I've got that here.
Which looks like that lovely device there. So that's a 3.5-inch hard drive, which refers to the width of it. This is in contrast to 2.5-inch hard drives, typically, which are smaller, thinner drives that are found in, take a guess, what kind of computer? So laptops. So that typically implies where it's found, although you can buy desktop computers with smaller hard drives for reasons of cost, heat, and price and other reasons. So what's inside of those things? Well, in this particular example, when we open that thing up in just a moment, we're going to find that there's one or more platters, metal platters, like sort of like old records, LPs, that themselves are made of metal, and on top of which are a whole bunch of magnetic particles. And those particles are aligned specially by some other device in there known as the reading head. So again, similar to an old phonograph player, there's a little reading head that moves back and forth, left and right, over these platters as they spin, say, 7,200 times per minute. And as they spin, are bits either written to the drive or read from the drive? Well, what does that mean? It means all the little random magnetic particles on the platter itself are just aligned in this order if you want to represent some ones, or perhaps in this order if you want to represent some zeros. So case in point, here we have the inside of this device. How many platters, Dan, are here?
There's one platter.
So there's just one platter. This, we said last week, it was how many megs or gigabytes of space?
This one?
Sorry? 10.2 gigabytes. So that's a pretty decent amount of space for just one platter here. This here is the reading head, which is going to go left to right, forward and back in order to read data there. But let's see, because this thing is now completely unusable, but we will pass it around, exactly what's going on when you actually are using these things in a real computer.
The hard drive is where your PC stores most of its permanent data. To do that, the data travels from RAM along with software signals that tell the hard drive how to store that data. The hard drive circuits translate those signals into voltage fluctuations. These in turn control the hard drive's moving parts, some of the few moving parts left in the modern computer. Some of the signals control a motor which spins metal-coated platters. Your data is actually stored on these platters. Other signals,
in this case, there's multiple reading heads, like multiple fingers.
This machinery is so precise that a human hair couldn't even pass between the heads and spinning platters. Yet, it all works at terrific speeds.
Okay, let's dive a little deeper now and see how those bits are actually written and read.
Look at what we just saw in slow motion. When a brief pulse of electricity is sent to the read-write head, it flips on a tiny electromagnet for a fraction of a second. The magnet creates a field, which changes the polarity of a tiny, tiny portion of the metal particles which coat each platter's surface. A patterned series of these tiny charged up areas on the disk represents a single bit of data in the binary number system used by computers. Now, if the current is sent one way through the read-write head, the area is polarized in one direction. If the current is sent in the opposite direction, the polarization is reversed. How do you get data off the hard disk? Just reverse the process. So it's the particles on the disk that get the current in the read-write head moving. Put together millions of these magnetized segments and you've got a file. Now, the pieces of a single file may be scattered all over a drive's platters, kind of like the mess of papers on your desk. So a special extra file keeps track of where everything is. Don't you wish you had something like that?
You might not think yourself the engineer, but hypothesize, if you would, for a moment, how it is that hard disks physically are not getting any bigger. They are still typically these 3.5-inch drives or 2.5-inch drives, and yet every few months, every year or so, we seem to get more and more data into those same form factors. How might the engineers making those things be doing that based on what's going on underneath the hood, would you say? So maybe the read-write head is getting smaller so that it can be even more precise as to what it's writing and what it's reading. What's the implication perhaps of that, though? That you're cramming more and more, say, particles into a more dense area on these platters, because the platters themselves clearly can't get any bigger if the drive itself is fixed at 3.5 inches. What else could you do? As that video kind of hints is an option vis-a-vis the actual hard drive that has the one platter. Yeah, so you can just layer more and more platters, and if you can get them thin enough, you can get multiple read heads in there and fit yet more and more data. And there's other techniques, more sophisticated ones still, but intuitively, those are among the innovations that people have had to in order to get more and more data without actually fundamentally changing, say, the size of these things or how they interface with a drive. So we talked now about a whole bunch of types of memory, not only what they're used for in general, but also how they work. But it turns out there's at least one other type of memory that we could make an even longer list if we wanted, and that's this thing known as virtual memory. How many of you on your own personal computers use virtual memory? This is one of those trick questions whereby all of your hands should be up. So this is something that most any modern operating system does for you out of the box. So Mac OS, Windows, Linux, all of these operating systems actually by default these days make use of some of your hard disk space as though it were RAM. That is, they kind of pretend that you have more than, say, the 1 gigabyte of actual RAM you have, or more than the 4 gigabytes of actual RAM that you have. And the way this works is as follows. If you are really kind of get a little nuts when it comes to running multiple things at once. You're not a fan of quitting software, closing Windows. You just keep double-clicking and open up another instance of this, multiple browsers. Minimize that one, but keep it running. Pull up AOL Instant Messenger. Pull up Google Talk, Facebook, this browser and that. If you've got a lot of stuff going on your computer at once, there might very well come a point where it just physically can't fit into RAM anymore, especially if you don't have much real RAM to begin with. And so what your computer does is, back in the day, it would just say, out of memory, quit some applications before you can load that program. But that's kind of annoying, right? And it's, the computer doesn't really need to make you quit a program if it can just kind of background it, so to speak. And so what modern operating systems do is they page to disk, so to speak. And by that, I mean they take some of the bits that are in RAM for some program that you're really not making use of at the moment because the window's minimized or no one's instant messaging you. It's just generally underutilized, that program. And the operating system evicts those bits from RAM and puts them, take a guess where? Back on the hard drive. Not where they came from, but rather in a small dedicated part of the hard drive that the operating system has claimed as its own, probably a few hundred megabytes, maybe a couple gigabytes, and it's just using it as temporary storage, scratch space, so to speak, so that it can remove those bits from RAM. Or really, it doesn't remove them as we know. It just reuses them for some other program. But the moment you maximize that window or someone instant messages you and the computer realizes, damn, I need those bits back because the user needs to interact with this program now, well, then the operating system puts everything else on hold, goes to the hard disk, grabs those bits, puts them back in RAM so that the CPU can continue executing them. But there's an implication of this. So one, there's the obvious upside of you can run more and more applications even if you don't physically have as much RAM as is warranted. But what might the downside of this be? So it kind of slows everything down, right? So this is a recurring theme in computing, in computer science, these trade-offs. You rarely get something for free. You have to pay for it somehow in terms of convenience or performance or money or some other metric altogether. And this time you do tend to pay for it in terms of performance. In fact, you can probably see this, or you've probably seen this already, if you do have a whole bunch of stuff running at once, some of which is minimized, and you decide, you know what, it's time for me to start using Microsoft Word again. Sometimes it doesn't pop up to the foreground of the screen immediately when you click it at the bottom of your screen. Sometimes it might actually churn a little bit to the point of you wondering what is going on. Your computer just feels like it's slowing down. And among the explanations might very well be that your RAM is pretty much filled up with other stuff you've been doing, or worse, there's some bugs, mistakes in some of the programs you're running, so they've been eating up memory but never giving it back, which is not your fault, just is sort of the state of the world. But the result for you is that it's taking longer and longer to load those bits back into RAM, because which is faster, RAM or hard disk? Well, RAM. So if you're using a hard disk or hard drive as though it were RAM, you're actually incurring this implicit cost. Now you're creating the illusion of more and more RAM to the user, but somehow you got to pay for that, and you're putting it on a bigger but slower device. And so virtual memory, to be clear then, is this use of hard disk space as though it were RAM. Good because you can do more at once, bad because you pay for it potentially in terms of responsiveness and in terms of speed. Now, so that we can close this loop and talk not only about the theoretics behind all this, but also sort of the real world question of, well, where do I go to get this stuff, right? Because many of you probably don't necessarily go to Dell or to Apple to just buy a whole new computer, but it's pretty reasonable to say, you know what, I only have a gig of RAM, I've looked at my user manual, I know I can fit more in there, or someone sort of technically savvy told me, why don't you go get some more RAM? Well, where do you go to do this? Where can you actually buy some of these items individually? Well, let's take a look. Yeah.
Is virtual memory using RAM as hard drive space, or the other way
around? Other way around. Question number here? Okay, so this is perhaps an exercise in places Dan and I like to go, but also price-conscious people like to go. One of the best sites, frankly, to look for, say, RAM, if you want to upgrade the RAM in your computer, is this site, frankly, DealRAM.com, because it's one of these aggregators that puts links to a whole bunch of different stores, e-commerce stores, where you can buy RAM, and someone has taken the time to actually provide you, the user, with the ability to search not only by the type of memory you have, but also even by the model number. So if you have a fairly common computer like the Dell something or other, you can just look it up and this site will tell you what type of memory is compatible so that you don't have to go to, say, apple.com and buy the the more expensive sort of Apple branded memory, or same thing from Dell. You can actually just get something that's compatible. To give you a sense of this, notice that there's a whole bunch of types of memory. So we've called RAM tonight RAM. Well, there's actually different types of RAM that very quickly would become mind-numbing in terms of the details distinguishing them, but you can certainly glance at this list and get a sense of, one, it looks like most RAM today is called DDR2 or maybe DDR3, and this generally refers to the size of it, the speed of it, and other technical specifications. How in the world do you know which of these and more, if I continue scrolling down, options you want? Well, you read the manual, or you pull up the web, your manufacturer's website, you say, I have the Dell something or other, and it will tell you what type of memory belongs in that computer. Then you look it up here, choose the right model number, like the PC2 4300 DDR at 533 megahertz, follow that link, and what you'll then be told is, for instance, that you have all of these different price options. So on the top left here, we have the different sizes that we can get. The times two means you get two sticks, that each of which is 512 megabytes. You get a whole bunch of links to resellers here. Now, there's certainly, as in any consumer domain, sort of trade-offs between brands you've heard of and some no-name brand that happens to be on the internet and is clearly cheap for perhaps that reason. So there is something to be said sometimes for going with brands that you know, and I think we'd be hard-pressed to sort of tell you, list all the types of places to go or all the types of memory, but you can get a sense of it. In the world of RAM, just to give you a sense, there's companies like Crucial, Kingston, OCZ, Mushkin, and then there's longer lists still. But just as in most spaces, the worlds of consumer electronics, are there brand names in some of these domains as well? Doesn't mean you have to go with them, because you will pay a premium perhaps, but just an FYI, if nothing else. One step better than this website because it's affiliated and more expansive, if I go to dealnews.com, frankly, this is one of the few sites that I sort of visit regularly because it aggregates current deals on not only RAM, but also computers and a whole bunch of other devices as well. I very often start here anytime I need like a hard drive for some computer, because I'll click on computer. I will then click on storage. And notice I'm staying on the right-hand side the whole time. I will click on hard drives. I will click on internal hard drives. And because I've taken E1, I know of these several models. There's these different types. There's IDE hard drives, which are somewhat older and outdated these days. Notebook hard drives, which is just a user-friendly way of saying 2.5-inch hard drives. SCSI hard drives, which tend to be used for specialized computers. And then serial ATA, or SATA hard drives, which are the currently most popular ones in computers. I'm going to click that link, which again, someone told me to click, or I looked at the manual for my computer, and now I get, apparently, a link to like this top one. For $60, I can get a 400 gigabyte internal hard drive from whatever website this is from, Staples, in fact. So whereas, to be clear, some people like myself wouldn't go into a store to buy, say, an entire computer, you can absolutely get some amazing deals on individual parts like this. So I would absolutely urge you to search these meta search engines before going to a store. Yeah? So it's a good question. The short answer is if you've got, a 200 gig hard drive and you decide I need more space, I want a 500 gig hard drive, and you have a PC, for instance, you can buy a new one and then copy the old hard drive's contents to the new one, thereby having 300 gigabytes of free space available, but it's non-trivial. It's not that easy. Simpler is to take your 200 gigabyte hard drive, leave it in the computer, buy the new one, and then add it to your computer such that you have a C drive with 200 gigs and then like a D drive or whatever that's 300 gigs that itself is blank. It's not a perfect solution because when you install software, it almost always wants to go where on a PC? You know, like C:\program files, well, that's still going to be on the original drive. So there you can sort of run into problems if that space is really filled up. But this problem is beginning to go away as manufacturers come up with sort of illusions of larger hard disk space, or you start using external storage, which makes it even easier to connect hard drives. I would say it's not as easy as it should be these days still to buy a hard drive and add it to your own computer without having some degree of patience, at least, if not some technical savvy. But it's doable, and it's meant to be doable.
Well, I think there are some variations. You could get, rather than an internal hard drive, actually, can you keep it on this page for a second? Mm-hmm. Rather than an internal hard drive, you could get an external hard drive, for example, which are usually connected via USB 2, which the ports we discussed last week. Some are even FireWire, which is a port many computers have, mostly on Apple computers. But you can see that here, rather than it being the bare hard drive, you can see that there's a box surrounding the hard drive. And they're usually a little bit more for the same size or for the same amount of space. But it's a very easy way of adding additional space. But like David said, you wouldn't then be able to, this wouldn't be your C drive, for example. You couldn't just put everything in one place. You would have to fragment your data, put a lot of your applications on your internal hard drive, for example, and then put maybe all of your files or on your external ones, so all your music, all your photos, for example, any videos that you download, you'd put on your external drive. And of course, it does depend on your computer. Laptops, for example, very, very few have the ability to hold more than one hard drive. So if you wanted to upgrade the hard drive in your laptop, and plus laptops are tricky things to open in general, so you might have to take additional steps to increase the hard drive space in your laptop. Whereas desktops, many of them do have the capability to hold more than just the one hard drive that you have. For example, can you go back a page? I just recently bought, keep going, one more, the internal SATA drive, wherever it is. There was actually a 1 terabyte drive. They're ridiculously cheap now. It's this one right here for $126. And it's actually the fifth hard drive that I'll be putting into my computer. And it's because I'm very paranoid and I back up everything onto every other hard drive. And so anyway, that's none of your concern. But really here,
thank you
for
sharing.
See that there, it's very, very cheap for every gigabyte that you have. So this is, in this case, 13 cents for every gigabyte. And so these things are getting remarkably cheap. However, there is a little bit of a problem, and that is when I get this hard drive in the mail in a couple days and I plug it into my computer, I'm not going to see that I have a terabyte of additional space. What am I going to see? Yeah, less. It's going to be something like 931 gigabytes. And so why is this? This is certainly very, very frustrating as you start to learn more about computers. Why on earth do you start to get computers that promise that are going to have 300 gigabytes of space or 500 gigabytes of space, and you actually have much less, some significant percentage less than that? So for example, in this computer right now, I have what was advertised to be a 60 gigabyte drive, but you can see that the capacity here says 55.58 gigabytes. What accounts for the difference? So I'm talking about capacity. I'm not talking about how much stuff I have on here. You can see that I've used 30 gigabytes on it, but I have available 25. So it's pretty much, it adds up to the capacity again, the raw capacity. Yes. So, right, that's a good guess, but it's not that, because the operating system is listed under the used. So part of this 31 gigabytes is the operating system itself. You notice that it's roughly the same percentage for every hard drive. And as the hard drives get larger, the less space you seem to have. So whereas this one, for example, is 55.5 gigabytes for an advertised 60 gigabyte drive, the 1 terabyte drive that I'm getting is going to have 70 gigabytes less, so to 930 gigabytes. So what accounts for this difference? Yes?
When you convert to bytes to gigabytes, it has to do with that, but I'm not exactly sure how to...
Exactly. So what... They calculate the size of the hard drives differently. So when we talk about something being giga, so let's just talk about this 60 gigabyte drive that I have, for example. What we have been talking about is that in order to convert this 60 gigabytes into bytes, we multiply by a billion, right? So let's see, 1,000, million, billion. So that's 1 followed by 9 zeros, and we get 60... 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 bytes. So 60 billion bytes of information. And this is what we would expect to see on this listing for the capacity. However, hard drives, just like everything else, are measured in bits, or ones and zeros. And the problem is that a gigabyte measured in base 2, or the binary, is different than how we would measure it in base 10. So how many bits? So we've talked about how we have 1 byte, which is how many bits? Right, which is 8 bits. And then we have 1 kilobyte. 1 kilobyte, I'm going to abbreviate, which is how many bytes? So it's not actually 1,000, it is actually 1,024. And the reason for that is because that is a power of 2. So this is actually equal to 2 to the 10th power. So it's not actually 1,000. It's actually a little bit more. So if we were to take this 60,000 bytes that I have and divide it by 1,024, so we divide this by 1,024, and then another 1,024, and then another 1,024, we actually get the actual capacity of this hard drive, which is the 55.58 or something like that, 55.58. And that's because they are measuring the sizes or the capacities of their hard drives in base 10. So they're saying, okay, it's 60 gigabytes times 1,000. But that's not actually how the hard drive is manufactured. That's not actually how the data is being read on this drive. It's because of the difference between base 10, where a kilo or a kilobyte is 1,000, versus base 2, which is in actuality 1,024 bytes. So just like 1 kilobyte is 1,024 bytes, 1 megabyte is 1,024 kilobytes. Which is 1,024 times 1,024 bytes. So it's really, again, just a marketing thing, and all hard drive manufacturers do it, even though they shouldn't, because the first person or the first hard drive manufacturer to actually report what their hard drives can't contain, they'll be behind the game. Just because they'll say if this hard drive manufacturer for this 1 terabyte drive, for example, actually listed it as being 930 gigabytes, well, who's going to buy that for the same price as another manufacturer that says it's 1 terabyte? So it's just continuously propagating this incorrect calculation of the size of the hard drive. And really, you don't have to know, you know, the actual math here, but just realize that it's the difference between counting in base 10 and counting in base 2, where a kilobyte is 1,024. Yes? What do you mean for software? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, okay, you say that 70 gigs are missing from a terabyte.
Yes.
So if I'm installing a 10 megabyte program, it says that this file is 10 megabytes, but it would actually be 9 point something.
So no, on your computer, if you're looking on your computer, it will report in the size in binary, so in base 2. So here, for example, the capacity is listed as 55.58 gigabytes, which means that it's calculating that based on 1,024 kilobytes being 1 byte, and so on and so forth. And all the rest on the computer is calculated in that same way. Usually for software, there's a lot. Usually when they say if software is going to take 10 megabytes of space, it's a little bit more complex than that. It really depends on your installation. Sometimes software has other dependencies, requires other little pieces of software in order for it to operate. So it may be more, it may be less, and that really has nothing to do with this change here in between decimal and binary.
For years, computer monitor manufacturers used to play this game, whereby if you bought a 17-inch CRT, sort of the TV-style monitor, it's not 17 inches diagonally. It's like 16 inches diagonally with one inch of the glass behind the plastic rim of the monitor. Fortunately, LCD and plasma TV manufacturers and monitor manufacturers these days don't play those games so much anymore. But it's the same thing. It's purely, I'll be less diplomatic. It's complete sham and very confusing to the average consumer. But if everybody does it, as Dan says, everybody else does it.
No, it really sucks. It's terrible.
You one-upped my less diplomatic comment.
I want my 1 terabyte of space. I want to say that I have 3 terabytes on my computer, but no, it's 2.5 or something like that.
Tough. It's tough. Let's pause for a moment and see if you have any questions, whether technically oriented or consumer oriented, since we've covered a lot of stuff.
I heard you mention a stick.
So it depends on the context. The memory stick can either be the RAM that's inside of your computer. Oh, okay. So that's different. So some people call RAM just a stick of RAM, and so sometimes you can hear it as being called a memory stick. But also, there are the little USB memory sticks which you can plug into your computer, which have now numerous gigabytes of space on them. But also, digital cameras, for example, have SD cards, or there's a number of acronyms here as well, CF cards, various other things. Those could also be called memory sticks, depending on who you talk about. And Sony's version of that memory card, not being an SD or a CF, is actually called, the brand name is memory stick. And so on your VAIO, you'll usually see a little slot for a memory stick, but that's not the same as this RAM. It's just a competing format among many other formats in these digital cameras, such as SD, CF, a number of other things.
I mean, it's remarkable. Those of you who have digital cameras or have memory card readers on your computer, these days they sort of throw in the kitchen sink, where if you get a memory card reader, you'll get something with like 4, 5, 6 different slots of different sizes, which are meant to handle things like compact flash cards, SD cards, micro SD cards, and a whole bunch of others. And to put things in perspective, both Dan and I, being the types of people we are, we both carry these things, which are SanDisk USB drives or jump drives or USB sticks. It's a whole bunch of buzz surrounds these things. They're just like miniature hard drives, but they have no moving parts other than this manual thing to just retract it. But rather, this is flash memory, where essentially when you store zeros and ones, it's stored electronically, but in a way that doesn't require more and more electricity to keep it alive, as in the case of RAM. So this is 8 gigabytes, which is pretty impressive. It's only a month or so old. My cell phone, for instance, and this isn't even the biggest of them, so there's this slot on the BlackBerry, like with other phones as well, and it's ridiculous. It really looks like a sliver of chocolate this thing here is, take a guess, how big, if you can see it.
4 gigabytes.
Oh, no, you're going to be disappointed. It's 1 gigabyte. they make 4 gigabyte versions now that are the same size. These are micro SD cards. I mean, they're ridiculously small. And what this means is you can store hundreds of photos on, like, your cell phone just by inserting this into your drive. The funny thing is, too, when you buy these things, I mean, where would you put this in your laptop or your desktop? I mean, so the stupid thing is that this thing comes with an adapter, which is bigger. And I've even seen adapters for the adapter. So it's like those Russian dolls. You have to sort of build it back up to normal people standards if to actually get it into your computer. So we've talked now about all these different types of memory, but not one of the most popular. When you rent a movie from, say, Netflix or Blockbuster, or you buy some software that needs to be installed from a disk, well, those disks these days are either CDs or they're DVDs. How much data, now that we've slapped numbers on these other technologies, can fit on a typical CD? Yeah, so it's about 650, 700 megabytes. So for a CD, just to put this down, CD-ROM, ROM standing for what generally? Yeah, read-only memory. So a CD-ROM just means compact disk hyphen read-only memory. And that makes sense for the most part, because if you buy a CD from a store containing like Microsoft Office or whatnot, you can read it, you can install it, but you can't change what's on that disk because the cheapest of CDs are read-only. And these things, again, come in like 650 to 700 megabytes. To put that into perspective, into, we'll come full circle in our multimedia lecture, music comes on CDs, and you can fit, let's say, 10 songs on a CD. You know, typically, that's how many comes from an artist. So what that means is that each song is like 65 to 70 megabytes each when stored on that CD. Now, this is much bigger than what other popular audio format these days. So MP3s. So MP3s are a technology, a file format we'll talk about in our multimedia lecture. They're like 1/10 the size and still sound pretty darn good, although true audiophiles can certainly tell the difference. But we'll see that when we get to our multimedia lecture, even though we're talking about things being measured in megabytes and gigabytes and whatnot, there's this whole world that exists called compression, which allows us to take that amount of data, compress it down, either by just throwing away information we don't need, as in the case of MP3s, or don't think we need, or just compressing it or storing it more cleverly. So we're not actually losing information, we're just storing it using less space. But CDs also come in the flavor of, say, CDRs. What's a CDR? So this is CD recordable, and this is a disc. Looks almost the same, except they sometimes have a greenish or a bluish or another color tint. And this is a recordable disc, which means you can write data to it, but there's a gotcha. Only once. Recordables can, dash R's can only be written to once. They're pretty much the same size, and you have to have special CD burning software. To burn a CD means to write data to it, but once, and that's the sense in which it's burned. Or some operating systems, Mac OS and Windows XP and Vista these days, come with the ability built in to just drag files to like your D drive and go to the file menu or whatever and say burn these files to disk or write these files to disk. Well, there's another type altogether which isn't really that popular these days, CD-RW, which is rewritable. So every R here sort of stands for something different, unfortunately. But rewritable just means you can actually add files, remove files, and so forth. But CDRs are probably still the most popular. Unfortunately, there is their scarier cousin, the world of DVDs. So DVD-ROM, you can imagine, is read-only. This is when a program like Microsoft Office no longer fits on a single CD, and certainly no longer fits on floppy disks like it did not all that long ago. DVDs also come in DVD-R, which is the same thing, recordables. But unfortunately, they also come in DVD-plus-Rs. So, which is also recordable, but the plus means it's a slightly different technology. This sort of reflects the world's inability to agree on one standard when it came to these things. And so you can buy both CDs and drives that are either minus R or plus R, but thankfully these days, both. So the world has sort of recognized, ugh, enough of this, let's just support all of these formats. So for the most part, doesn't really matter which one of the disks you buy, dash R or plus R. Personally, after doing a bunch of research a while ago, I sort of decided that minus R was ever so slightly more popular, and so I went with that. But the drives that are inside your laptops or desktops tend to read all of these formats, so that's less of an issue. How much space can fit on a DVD? Yeah, so the number most people slap on it is 4.7 gigabytes or more these days, depending on how the data is written. So we won't go into too much detail here, but one of the neat things about optical media, that is media like CDs and DVDs that are written and read to using lights, lasers, is that you can kind of aim that laser at a different angle and sort of write to a different part of the disk. So you'll hear about things like dual layer disks, which means you're actually storing data on two different layers of the disk itself, but using slightly different angles. And you can kind of see this on older DVD players, because even DVDs you'd rent from the store or buy that play movies, if you have a DVD player that's a few years old still, if you watch roughly halfway through the movie, there will be an ever so slight pause in the movie. And that's typically explained by the laser moving from like this angle to this angle. The manufacturers just weren't very good at hiding that particular transition, at least in yesteryear. So how does this actually work? Well, let's dive in deeper with this.
If I can interject, there is actually the new competing formats that you've probably heard of. Well, the one that's sort of won out recently is this new Blu-ray disc that's been added. And those also have come in read-only and writable formats. Luckily, it's none of this confusing Blu-ray minus R, Blu-ray plus R business. There's just the Blu-ray read-only and the Blu-ray read and write, or rather the Blu-ray the Blu-ray writable as well. But these come in quite a bit bigger sizes. So did you mention that they are actually the same physical size as well? So the CDs and the DVDs are the same size, but also now the Blu-ray discs are the same size. And those are typically for the single layer now 25 gigabytes in size. The double layer now, I think it must be double that, so 50 gigabytes in size, which is pretty impressive. And the reason for that they call it Blu-ray is just to, again, for marketing purposes, they've sort of changed the laser. Now it's this blue laser instead of red, which is supposed to be finer, sort of like a finer tip pen. You can write more on the same space than you can with a larger tip pen.
And that's, of course, important, because when was the last time you looked at your own DVD player's laser color? Probably never. Yeah, but
who knows? Anyway, this will hopefully make more sense as David shows this video that we have for you here.
How can a CD-ROM disk hold so much more than a conventional disk? The CD drive reads data with a beam of light so narrow that the information can be squeezed together much tighter. You see, a laser diode creates this concentrated beam of light. The light travels through a prism. Then, through a lens magnetic coil that focuses the beam even more. On the other side of the compact disk itself are millions of tiny bumps called pits.
That's right. The bumps are called pits.
The same surface has smooth areas called lands. These pits and lands are translated into the binary language of bits and bytes used by the computer.
Let's dive ever so slightly deeper.
Patterns of pits and lands are laid out along a continuous spiral. As the disk turns, a precise motor keeps the laser beam in place on the pad. Where the laser beam hits a pit, the light is scattered. But where it hits a land, the beam is reflected straight back along its original path. The light enters the prism again, but this time it is reflected at a 90-degree angle and strikes a device called a diode. The diode creates an electric pulse each time the light hits it. So when the laser hits a pit, no light bounces back. When it strikes a land, the diode sees the reflection and sends a pulse. These blanks and pulses are sent to the computer, which interprets them as a pattern of zeros and ones. In other words, into binary code.
So this actually describes store-bought CDs and effectively store-bought DVDs in the world of rewritable media or recordable media that we ourselves might use at home. They actually use a slightly different technique, which is to have a thin film on a CD and a DVD is pretty much just a cheap piece of plastic. But on top of that is actually a thin layer of film that can be distorted by certain types of lasers. And so what's really happening when you burn a CD or even a DVD at home is that you're not burning a hole roll, which is kind of reversible probably, but rather you're distorting this film in such a way that the next time a laser light bounces off of it, it's going to refract at a different angle, thereby representing a different value from 0 versus 1. And the upside of using that approach as opposed to burning a hole in the thing is that you can, again, reverse the process, which tends to be useful. And you can do it on commodity hardware as well.
On the one hand, though, you could consider it burning because it is actually performing this chemical change, and when you burn things, usually you get this sort of black carbon residue. It's not, of course, actually literally burning the disk, but it is actually initiating this change so that the light is no longer being reflected in the same way. So just like you had said, it's just a different way to think about it.
Well, I think before we conclude with an exciting sneak preview, I think John wanted to make an announcement about sections.
Yes. So after carefully examining your responses, sections will be Monday at 6:30 and Thursday at 8:35. Location to be announced.
So what we'll do on the course's website, computerscience1.org, is post a very obvious announcement about the locations for those starting this Thursday. For those of you who can't make any of those times, rest assured that Dan, myself, John, Chris will certainly make ourselves available to chat either before or after class, during office hours, during the week. We tend, rather than organizing sort of a fixed set of hours, which no one can ever sort of all make, is we're happy to meet on an ad hoc basis, simply by giving us a ring or dropping us a note. So next week is kind of one of my favorite lectures, which is ironic because we don't have to do any talking. It's our first of two movie nights in the course, whereby we'll meet here, same time, same place. Prior to class, though, Dan and I will have made a trip to Kendall Square, where our friend Johnny mans the popcorn stand there, with whom we've built up a relationship over the past several years. About a couple times a year, we go over there with some cash and with big plastic bags, and we come back, having exchanged one for the other, with one filled with lots of bags of individual popcorn. We'll also pick up some sodas and maybe some candy here, and we really will turn it into a nice little communal movie night. And the movie we'll see will give us a glimpse into the world of software, certainly the beginnings of the software that we all know and love or hate, namely Windows and Mac OS. So this movie is Pirates of Silicon Valley, which is a dramatization of the rise of both Microsoft and Apple, who curiously did have a relationship, personal relationships in the earliest of days, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and so forth. And so this is a dramatization in that we have Noah Wiley, of ER fame, who portrays Steve Jobs, Anthony Michael Hall, who depicts Bill Gates. With that said, Dan, unless you have something additional, I thought I'd play this sneak preview here.
I think you can bring one friend or a spouse or your significant other or something if you did want. It is, like David said, to be a communal activity, so do feel free to bring one person.
But apparently only one person. Okay. So let me go ahead and expand this here. It's actually great fun, this film, and it's the sort of film that you probably haven't seen on your own. That doesn't make it bad.
Bill Gates and Steve Jobs were never ordinary kids.
Why only computer?
Because they didn't want them to.
And while they did not then, their paths would cross. Change their lives and change the world.
I don't even think anybody knows who we are. Good.
Professor, you realize that's like stealing from a book?
If you don't know Beans, chair at Microsoft, the rest of your life, it's good to see you.
Their race to the top will turn technical revolution into cultural revolution.
You guys are supposed to be writing programs.
We demolished that guy.
Let me just have something at me and look about a decade out of date.
I want it.
It's Apple's. We can't just go and steal it.
I want it!
They will take on the world and take on each other.
What does he want? Keep your friends close and your enemies close.
We're here for our 9:30 with your president, Mr. Gates.
The era of competition between us is over.
Chris stole a multi-billion-dollar industry from America's corporate giants. No worry as Steve Jobs, Anthony Michael Hall as Bill Gates. Pirates of Silicon Valley.
All right, we'll see you next Monday.